This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
My next guest is an expert, I think I can say, in Pacific gardening, all the way from California up to Washington State. She's the editor of Pacific Horticulture Magazine. We'll talk about that. She's at the fair making a presentation about rewilding, making room for nature in the city. I know that will interest many of you. So without further ado, Lorene Edwards-Forkner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Big topic, rewilding, making room for nature in the city. What is that about?
My notion of it, and I always shy away from the moniker of expert. I prefer to think curious. I'm always learning. I'm by no means feel like I've arrived. The more I learn, the more I know what there's left to learn. So anyway, that's my hesitation at the word expert. But what I have come to enjoy learning more about is this notion of nature as a system, checks and balances and actions and consequences, and how humans fit into that, that nature is no longer a wildlife preserve or a zoo or a, you know, a some place where humans can't, if we show up, we wreck it, and tends to be what happens. And so how can we rewild our notion of what that nature is, and how can we get it back in the city alongside humans? How can we play a role in it, a cooperative role in it?
Well, I think we're talking about more than just parks then, too, because there's all sorts of green things growing in unexpected places in the city.
Nature fills in wherever there's a gap, and that could just as easily be a crack in the sidewalk as, you know, a clogged up gutter. I've seen very invasive butterfly weed bushes blooming three stories off of the ground in a backed up gutter. You know, nature fills in. The butterfly will feed on the nectar of the buddleia bush, and you know, that's its own little ecosystem right there. I don't necessarily recommend planting butterfly bushes because they will seed into your gutters and get a little bit out of hand. But yes, our role to invite nature back into the city, to invite nature back into our gardens, is to leave room for it.
So what should we do then? Should we go to our council meeting? Should we meet with our neighbors? What's the plan to try and make our city a more eco-friendly place?
I think most of all is to, again, it comes back to education. Learn what it is that is going to best support these systems. And, you know, it seems fairly obvious, but pavement. Pavement is kind of a bad thing on all levels. Let's start breaking up the pavement and keeping the water in the land, keeping it on site, which is going to help on a municipal level to waste treatment. We're also, you know, exposing more land to cultivation for nature to move in on. So that, you know, they always say buy land, they're not making it anymore. But every time you break up the pavement or plant a rooftop or put in a garden or even a container garden, you've created a little piece of nature there. You've opened it up again. You are, in essence, making land. And once you learn about the native pollinators, the birds that move through our cities, and you realize what a wasteland or kind of a parking lot, virtual paved over parking lot, our cities become when a native pollinator can only forage out about 300 feet from their nest. Something as simple as the parking lot of your grocery store can be an insurmountable barrier. They can't get from the gardens on one side to the gardens on the other side because it's more than 300 feet. So we have a little ribbon of planting or something with flowers and nectar sources and things that bloom at various times of the year through the middle of it. We make these little corridors and pathways. That's making room for these pollinators and other critters and wild things alongside us. You know, I'm not a proponent of locking humans out of nature.
You've told me something I just did not know at all about these limitations of the pollinators. What about also another big debate that we just had recently on Radio EcoShock due to Orion Magazine had a teleconference about this was whether we should be looking exclusively at trying to put back what was here before we came with native species, or is it okay to have some non-native species that are going to thrive in the new conditions that we've created?
Absolutely. There really isn't a lot of sense in going back because it's unachievable and it's demoralizing and depressing and, you know, all those things that kind of stop the process before we even begin. And that's why I'm saying, you know, it's a 21st century way of looking at nature, and it's where we are now. There's a fabulous book called Rambunctious Garden, and she talks about a 21st century hybrid of humans and wildlife management. And it's different. I mean, when you start getting into those native plant conversations, you know, native to what point in time? Native to First Nations, native to before humans, native to, you know, even our prairies at one time were forest. So you start spinning your wheels because you're so busy defining what's correct without getting anything done. And even that notion of what is right or correct is a very human construct. You know, nature, meanwhile, is just filling in and doing their work, which is a cautionary tale on import of exotic plants, because so many of them, while seeming to be a perfectly good idea to begin with, whether it be kudzu or the Himalayan blackberries that are all over the Pacific Northwest, the kudzu was brought into the South to control erosions in such a wet climate. It does, and then it swallows the nation whole. I heard a story recently where scotch broom, which is such a horrible pest on the Pacific coast and does so much in the way of displacing native plants that and can't compete with it, that it started in the late 19th century from three seeds somehow picked up in Hawaii by a Scotsman who was up on Vancouver Island and was nostalgic for home. So sentimentality and that human emotions that's, you know, we can lead us to unwittingly unleash some, you know, plant that can do a lot of damage over time. I'm not saying we can't have our sentimentality in the garden. I've tried to grow a beefsteak tomato in Pacific Northwest. That's very sentimental and naive, but to be aware and to be conscious and responsible for it too.
What are some of the growing conditions that people in the Northwest encounter that people in Arizona or in Ohio would not know about?
We have one of the longest daylight hours in the entire continental United States. Certainly Alaska can beat us out in spades, but in terms of just, you know, our day this morning probably started around 4:30 with daylight, and it will be dusk at close to 10 o'clock. That is a very, very, very long growing season. We also have such moderate temperatures that we can probably cultivate something in the garden and it can be actively growing 8 or 9 months of the year. So between those long days and those long months, we have one of the longest growing seasons in the country. On the other hand, we have almost constant cloud cover. We never get truly hot, although we complain bitterly if things go above about 75, because we have that maritime influence. So it's one of the most hospitable growing conditions in the country, but we really need to learn to love our cool season vegetables and kale and cabbages and beans and, you know, things that will flourish under those hospitable growing conditions we do have, not quite spend so much of our sentimentality trying for that giant beefsteak tomato.
Well, it's too bad the people of Seattle can't grow coffee beans. Then everything would be perfect.
Yeah, we could be completely a closed-loop society.
Well, you're the editor of Pacific Horticulture magazine, and I gather that's not just about Washington State. Tell us what you do cover.
The Pacific Horticulture magazine is actually about 37, 38 years old. It's a nonprofit organization that was put together by various nonprofit horticultural societies on the West Coast looking to collectively publish a journal, a newsletter of sorts. And, you know, nonprofits, we're looking to be efficient and good use of our resources, but we do cover a tremendously diverse growing region. My friends in San Diego have no idea how I, you know, function up here. They come up and visit in June and are just wrapped in blankets. And, you know, I'm down there in February and just nearly giddy with the sunlight. But we also learn from all other parts of the country. I mean, so much of the California area is that Mediterranean climate that, you know, shows up in various parts of the world. It's a very unique growing conditions with the wet winters and the warm, dry summers. And so even though we could be talking about a garden in Santa Barbara, its roots may be in in Italy or in southern France or, you know, down along the Mediterranean coast or somewhere in New Zealand or Australia. And so it really is a global awareness of how nature works, whether it's, you know, inland Pacific Northwest or coastal San Diego, but interpreted very, very regionally, because when it comes down to it, it's all about very, very regional gardening. All gardening is local.
We're talking with Lorene Edwards-Faulkner, and you've written 5 gardening books. Would you care to tell us about your latest one?
The latest book is called The Timber Pressed Guide to Vegetable Gardening in the Pacific Northwest, and it was far and away the most blissful book to write because I love to talk about food, and I have a very small city garden. I'm not one of those, you know, self-sufficient gardeners. If my beefsteak tomatoes aren't ripening, we'll go to the farmer's market and I'll buy them from the good farmers in Yakima who have sunshine and greenhouses. But I like to talk to people about how they can grow a little bit of food for the longest period of time in their Pacific Northwest garden. They can be harvesting fava beans that they've overwintered first thing in the spring. They can be picking salad greens almost every month of the year. We can enjoy that brief sunny, hot period we get in August and September, but all the good food that comes in between all the other months as well.
And you're giving a workshop at the Mother Earth News Fair on cultivating secondary crops for innovative cooking. What's that about?
Yeah, that sounds all very heady and scientific. I call it nose-to-tail eating in the vegetable garden. And butchers talk about this all the time, about being efficient with the whole hog, as it were, and all the, you know, some of them talk about the nasty bits, you know, the organ meat and the offal and, you know, the things you don't want to look at. Doing so in the vegetable garden is not nearly so frightening, and nothing is really nasty.
There's all sorts of little temperature gauges out there in the garden. I talked with a gardener from Texas who said he didn't get his tomato plants because they had a hot spell where it didn't cool down to about 68 degrees at night. And when that happened, it flowered. Mm-hmm. There were bees buzzing around. No fruit set.
Yeah, yeah. The flowers become sterile. They're inactive. They're non-functioning. You know, that may be the next awareness of our pollination kind of tragicomedy that we're working out. You know, we're learning about the importance of the pollinators on the food we eat, but we're going to start to discover how the climate affects that pollination factors too. And that's going to be another wave.
That's something I've been talking to a few gardeners about is preparing sort of for the extreme garden, because maybe a little less in the Pacific Northwest, but in many parts of the United States and other parts of the world, Australia in particular too, you get heat waves, you get sudden violent storms, you get hail storms, you can get extreme rainfall events where suddenly 3, 4, 5 inches of rain fall, so you've got to have your garden set up to manage that. You don't want everything flooded mm-hmm. out and washed away. Mm-hmm. Especially if it's seeding time. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, how are people going to be a little bit more agile and still get the food they
That's
love?
That's a really good way. And it sort of fits into that definition of rewilding, because, you know, Mother Nature's done plenty of rewilding in the last 12 to 18 months. I've seen a lot of personal friends who have lost their entire shade canopy with tremendous freak ice storm event that we had here in the Pacific Northwest. We saw Superstorm Sandy literally bring the beach all up over, you know, parts of New York, and incredibly toxic conditions for growing things. I think more and more people are going to start growing more perennial crops of food, getting back to fruit trees and shrubs and you know, the asparagus, the rhubarb, the things that are going, they're just a lot more resilient plants. Their roots are going to hold the ground in place. We're going to seed things around them, but they're going to be our anchors in the landscape. So many people, I mean, almost anybody with a home who's taking care of their landscape is putting in woody plants and trees and shrubs and seeding things and perennials. And if we just start replacing those, kind of parting out the non-productive plants with more productive plants, we can have our shade tree and our apple crop or walnuts or something like that. And that's going to be a more resilient food production system than those open fields that can wash away.
Those are some great ideas. Laureen Edwards Faulkner, how do people follow up with you? Do you have a blog? And certainly, would you give us your website?
I will give a couple of websites. PacificHorticulture.org is the website for the magazine. We publish most of our content that we print in the magazine, which comes out four times a year, but we publish most of it online. We're a nonprofit organization. We're just trying to educate and inspire. So we give it away freely. And then my own personal website is called Planted at Home. I live and work and garden and toil from home. And so that seemed appropriate.
And that's plantedathome.com?
Plantedathome.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
We are out of time once again. I'm Alex Smith. Get links for this show and my show blog at ecoshock.info. Back the program and get free downloads at the website ecoshock.org. Welcome to all our new listeners, and thank you for listening and caring about your world.